Welcome back, Question Medicine. 2019 is the Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It's another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know what it means. Time to hear my voice for about 20 minutes while I talk about what I'm reading about, get in what I'm getting on. And before I get started, I just want to say a quick shout out to Paul. Paul, you know who you are. You wrote me an email to the Questioning Medicine Gmail account way back in June, actually. And I just now got it because I rarely check that account. If you want to email me, if you're a listener and you want to email me anything, a question, if you want an article sent to you, if you have a question about an article, or you just want to say, hey, listen, really appreciate the podcast, keep up the good work, any of those are much appreciated, especially the last one. But you can just email me directly. Yes, me, Andrew Built, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. AndrewBilt@gmail.com. And I will respond to you much faster than I did to you, Paul, because again, I don't check that. I just checked it now 5 months later. So luckily you didn't have an urgent pressing question that you needed help with because I was not there for you on that one. But now without further ado, let's kick this thing off. So without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. Here we go, Andrew Bill, Question Medicine, 2019. Let's kick this thing off. You see, I talk all the time about the shared decision-making conversation and how I think that we should tell the patients everything they need to know and maybe then some so that way they can have an informed decision to discuss or to actively participate in their own care. We know that individuals who actively participate in their own care will not only do better, but they'll be more engaged in their own care and they're more likely to follow up, which is the important part because too often you are lost to follow up. Now, there is a time when too much is too much, and that is no more clearly seen than in this paper from JAMA titled Effect of Sequential or Active Choice for Colorectal Cancer Screening Outreach, a Randomized Clinical Trial. You see, they gave patients options for colon cancer screening. And we know that colon cancer screening only works when you do it. It's like all the medications that my patients don't pick up. They don't work if you don't get them. This was just over 400 patients randomized in one-to-one-to-one fashion for colon cancer screening, and there were three different groups. Here were the three groups. Group number one, you got a direct phone number to schedule a colonoscopy. Group number two, a direct phone number to schedule a colonoscopy, and you were mailed a FIT kit if you had no response within 4 weeks or within a month. And then group number three, you were given a direct phone number to call for a colonoscopy, and you were mailed a FIT kit together in combination. We didn't wait 4 weeks for you to pass go. You just got it right away. So what do you think? What do you think happened? Well, there was no difference in the completion rates between groups, which I found quite shocking. I definitely thought the group that was only just go schedule a colonoscopy would be a lot fewer than those that were offered the FIT kits either at 4 weeks or right away. But if you were offered a FIT kit, you didn't choose the colonoscopy. Only half of those individuals that chose colonoscopy when FIT was mailed to them 4 weeks later, and if you were offered a FIT kit the exact same time that you were also offered the phone number to schedule for a colonoscopy, then only 33% or about a third of the patients went to colonoscopy. We know that patients in general suffer from information overload. We give them too much information, which is usually a bad thing because they may not be able to handle it. Although for me, if I'm the patient, give me all the information and let me decide what really is best for my own health. I think in the end here, the important part is we should have a shared decision-making conversation with the patient and discuss with them the limitations of colon cancer screening. It doesn't necessarily improve all-cause mortality, although the evidence is better than any other screening exam that we have, but it definitely prevents disease-specific mortality. In the end, do they want colon cancer screening or not is the better question. What kind of colon cancer screening they get, I don't know if that's necessarily the most important question because we don't have clear evidence that any of the tests are better than another one. So why not give them the least invasive one, the one that doesn't require many hours of prep and sitting on the toilet. The one that doesn't require you to have anesthesia, the one that doesn't require any bowel perks, the one that doesn't require you to have a designated driver to come that morning. And of course, I'm talking about our stool cards, our fit test, our DNA fecal test, anything that doesn't require a 2-foot snake up my rear. With that, let's rear our heads on to the next paper. Now, we as providers love to think that we are immune to everything, that we could never get cancer, that we could never die, that it could never happen to us. What is it, you say? Well, just really about anything. But we are only human, and that is no more clearly seen than in this paper titled Association of Primary Care Clinic Appointment Time with Opioid Prescribing. Just as the title suggests, it looks at what happens during the time of day to opioid prescribing. Does it get more lenient as the day goes on? We know that judges, as the day goes on, become a little bit more lenient. They say, less parole. Meh, it was just a little bit of a felony. Don't worry about it. But if you're the first one, when you're there at first thing in the morning, we are hardened. We are not ready. We are ready to say, no, you get no opioids. We are ready to say, you get 20 years in prison. So let's take a look and see how did physicians do. You see, we know that antibiotic prescribing gets a little bit more lenient as the day goes on. That is well documented. Even though we know that not prescribing the antibiotic, having the conversation to not prescribe the antibiotic only saves you about a minute compared to go ahead and writing for the antibiotic. This has been shown many times, as far back as 2003 from what I can find. So we know that it doesn't exist, but we just don't want to have the conversation. We don't want to go through the struggles of this is why you don't need the antibiotic. Same thing, I suspect, with opioids. This is why I'm not going to give you opioids. This is why you don't get it. This is why you don't qualify. We have this whole thing. It's a board. I don't want to give it to you. Blah, 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 blah. Let's be honest here. Burnout is real, and so is decision fatigue. It is easier to write for a script than it is to have a conversation. It is truly that the path of least resistance will almost always take hold. It'll almost always come true. So in this study, they looked at what happens to opioid prescribing as the day went on. And when they compared the first appointment to the 20th appointment, you were 33% more likely to prescribe an opioid during that later visit. And if you fell behind, if you were behind, let's say 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes, an hour long, and let's be honest, if you're a primary care physician, you know that falling behind is almost inevitable in this day and age. Well, as you fell behind, you were 17% more likely to prescribe an opioid. I think there are two main takeaways from this. First of all, if you're a patient and you want pain medications, then you should just go later in the day because you got a better chance of getting your pain medications if you go later in the day. But number two, and in all seriousness, doctors are humans. Providers are humans. I don't agree with prescribing opioids for almost anything. I'm very clear on that. But it happens, and I'm just as guilty of this. So I think it's important that we all are aware that it's going to happen. And when we write for the opioid, we should write for 4 pills, 5 pills, 3 pills, 0 refills. The patient doesn't need 10, they don't need 15, they don't need 20. They realistically probably don't even need it to begin with. But if you're going to write for it, get in the habit of only writing for a few pills, because eventually decision fatigue will set in, and it is important that you're not giving away extra opioids just for fun, just because you're tired of saying no patient after patient. And speaking of no, this next article, when I first read the title, I thought, oh, I know what this is about. Oh, I definitely know what this is about. And then I read the article and I said, oh, no, 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 no. That is not what I thought it was going to be about. It is this title in JAMA titled Finding the Right Words to Stop Cancer Screening in Older Adults. Now, originally I thought to myself, oh, I know what this is about. It is about cancer screening in telling people the risk and benefits, telling people how it's not what we think it is, telling people how the mammogram pink ribbon parade isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And then I read the article. This article ended up actually being about using the right words to stop cancer treating in the older adults, not all adults. You see, older adults being those individuals that have only a few years to live, those individuals who are working on quote-unquote borrowed time, those individuals that when they were born, the average age expectancy was, I don't know, 73, and they're 83. They are living with Who knows how many days left, but I can tell you they probably shouldn't buy green bananas. I'm, of course, just kidding, but only slightly, and cancer screening really is not beneficial if you don't have at least 10 healthy years to live. And so the question is, how do you tell these individuals, listen, you're too old, you don't need cancer screening? Or, listen, Grandma, you're going to die before cancer screening does any good whatsoever. We are more likely to do a biopsy, cause you harm, maybe drop a lung, than we are to find any significant cancer that's actually going to lead to any surmountable or evidence or prolonging of your life. Well, in this article, I will summarize it for you. Basically, patients and doctors both agree that after a shared decision-making conversation, it would be okay, and this is important, it would be okay if their doctor told them, you know, you probably don't need cancer screening anymore. But how do you say, hey, you don't need cancer screening anymore because you're going to die soon? I think from this article, the best thing that I took was these words right here, and I quote, congratulations, you've retired from cancer screening. Congratulations, you've retired from colon cancer screening. Congratulations, you have retired from mammograms. Putting it in a positive context, putting it in a positive light with a spin that makes it, hey, congratulations, you've now reached this point in your life where we don't have to do this anymore. You're definitely not telling a lie. You're definitely telling the truth. I think both parties in the room know what you're really saying. And with that, on to the next article. Now, earlier this podcast, we talked about psychology. Well, just really how the mind will do its own thing. And you have to understand the mind to understand patients. And doctors are patients in their own sense and will always revert to the path of least resistance. But this next article titled Effects of Open-Label Placebo on Pain, Functional Disability, and Spine Mobility in Chronic Back Pain Patients, a Randomized Controlled Trial. Just as the title suggests, this was an open-label placebo. I'm going to say it again. This was an open-label placebo, meaning the patients knew what they were getting. The patients knew that they were getting placebo. These were individuals that had low back pain and were told, we're going to give you placebo. And you would think, well, that would be nothing, right? That would be the equivalent of giving them nothing. But placebo is not nothing. And that is, again, no more clearly seen than in this trial. So this is why when we do other trials and we give somebody placebo, it's not nothing. We are giving them placebo. We are giving them a drug. Let's look at the details of this trial. It was 127 people over the age of 19 who had chronic back pain for at least 12 weeks, so at least 3 months of chronic back pain. They then randomized them to usual care or usual care plus placebo. However, they told the patients that were supposed to get placebo, there is this really powerful thing called placebo. You're going to watch this video on it. And this video, I don't know what the video was. It didn't give a link to the video. But this video said, look, placebo's awesome. And we know that if we tell you we're going to give you morphine, that you then have a response that is very similar to what morphine is. If we tell you we're going to give you a drug, you have a response that is very similar to whatever we tell you that drug is going to be, whether it be lowering your heart rate, lowering your blood pressure, even lowering your cholesterol. When you look at some of the cholesterol trials, when we told people we were giving them a drug to lower their cholesterol, even the placebo group had lower cholesterol numbers. This placebo group was then told to take the placebo pill twice a day for 21 days. The primary outcome was pain, and in those individuals who randomized placebo, there was almost a 1 point on an 11-point scale improvement with placebo. I know one out of an 11-point scale doesn't sound like a lot. I understand that. But there's very little side effects to placebo. There's no blood test, and again, it's just placebo. And when you look at other studies, like in the Annals of Rheumatology and Disease 2017, July, I mean, just in case you were looking at other articles, not that I was by any means, and a paper titled Non-Steroidal Anti-Inflammatory Drugs for Spinal Pain, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis, if you were looking at that, let's say, or any other really article, you would find that NSAIDs, yes, NSAIDs, the drug that we do give for low back pain, acute low back pain quite frequently, lowers your pain score about 0.7 to 0.9 on a 10-point scale, which is very similar to 1 on an 11-point scale. I find this article beyond fascinating, and I'm not sure what to do with it because I can't ever actually write for placebo. Is it the actual drug that it's placebo? Is it just the fact that the patient had or could share their experience with a provider, and that was therapeutic somewhat in and of itself? Was it just the fact that they thought somebody was caring about them? I'm not really sure, but this is fascinating, and I wish that I could write for placebo, because I can tell you, I think the antibiotics, the opioids, now even the NSAIDs for back pain would almost all be placebo. And let's get ready to close this out. Before I close it out, though, I'm going to end with three quick hits. I've never done anything like this before, but basically it is three what I think are more condensed versions of the things that I read or articles that I'm reading. Because I'll be honest with you, in order to give you five or six or seven good articles that I read, I have to read, I don't know, 20, 30 articles, and I just give you the five or six that I think are interesting. Unfortunately, in that lost in translation gap of 20-something articles is a whole bunch of really good information that you should probably know about. So I'm just going to break down in quick little nugget gems, some quick hits, some quick facts three times, and then we'll end this podcast as we have ended everyone before it. So there is going to be a new drug out for HIV PrEP. Yes, that is the drug you give before, to prep them to not get HIV, if you will. It's called Descovy, D-E-S-C-O-V-Y. And instead of being Truvada, which is N-centritamine tenofovir disproxil, this is N-centritamine tenofovir alphenamide. It works about the same efficacy, I guess, as Truvada, so don't worry about that. Both meds cost $1,500 to $2,000 a month, but good news, here you go. This is the important part that I took away. Truvada is going to be generic in fall of 2020, so basically 1 year from today, Truvada is generic. Now, it'll take a while to get it out there to market, but a generic drug, when the guidelines now say that we should be offering all those individuals at high risk PrEP, that is a good deal, my friends. That is a good deal. Speaking of deals, and not necessarily a good deal, but a bad deal, what about this new recall, the recall of Losartan? Because it is so concerning that maybe there are some impurities that came from China or Japan or where they came back from. And the whole concern with this Losartan recall that you're seeing, or Valsartan recall that you're seeing, has to do with nitrodimethylamine. I could have pronounced that wrong. But basically, it's this NDMA impurity. And here's the secret to it, is that everyone is exposed to this nitrodimethylamine all the time. NDMA. It is in small amounts in your water, it's in foods, bacon, grilled meat, dairy, you name it, it's in there. We all get it. But if you're going to stop the patient's blood pressure medication, or maybe the patient just wants to stop the blood pressure medication themselves, they read these news reports and they're like, oh my goodness, this is terrible. I gotta stop my drug because, you know, I heard it can kill you. Well, here's what you need to tell the patient. Treating hypertension is super important, and the FDA estimates that 8,000 patients would need to take the highest contaminated Valsartan or Losartan, never in combination, just by themselves, every single day for 4 years, and it could possibly, maybe, we're not even totally sure, lead to one additional lifetime diagnosis of cancer. Yes, 8,000 patients every single day for 4 years, and then maybe, at the highest possible dose of this contamination, it could maybe possibly lead to one cancer. That's not a lot. If you don't treat the blood pressure and it's sky high through the roof in 8,000 patients, I can tell you there will be at least one stroke or one cardiovascular event that will occur. So go ahead, treat the blood pressure, keep taking the medication, have no fear. Keeping the blood pressure low is near and dear to my heart. Speaking of hearts, let's talk about this last little piece, and that, of course, is dapagliflozin for heart failure. Yes, that is right, dapagliflozin for heart failure. Now, notice I didn't say dapagliflozin for heart failure in those with diabetics, because the most recent trial in the New England Journal of Medicine showed that using dapagliflozin for heart failure in all individuals over the course of 1.5 years prevented hospitalization or cardiovascular death in about 1 in 18 type 2 diabetics and 1 in 22 individuals without diabetes. That is, of course, compared to placebo. Now, this is huge, because that means dapagliflozin isn't a diabetic drug. It's a person drug. It's an all-people drug. And maybe the flozins just in general are not diabetic drugs. They're people drugs. You likely have already caught wind of this trial, this whole dapagliflozin. It made huge press headlines, and with good reason, because it made huge improvement with many patients in the trial already on current heart failure medications. So it not only did well, it did well in individuals that were already on the heart failure medications that we currently have. The problem with heart failure medications just in general is that as we keep adding medications, we're going to reach the point where there is limited benefit. You see, if you're not on any medications, it's not very hard for one drug to show some benefit. But if you're already on 3, 4, 5 medications, that next drug is only gaining you a very small amount, and it has to be exceedingly, unbelievably, undeniably awesome in order to get that amount, because you're already on 4 or 5 medications that are already giving you such a large benefit. The use of drugs and the addition of drugs for any kind of chronic disease is not a linear curve. So with this new dapagliflozin useful in all individuals in heart failure, what do you do? What do you do? Let's say you have a heart failure patient, again, with reduced ejection fraction lower than 40% or lower than 40% at some point. Maybe they gain a little bit of it back now, but lower than 40% with diabetes, and they're still having symptoms even after being maximized. Yes, maximized, not just 2.5 lisinopril, but maximized up to 40, getting max doses of the heart failure medications. What do you do? Should we add dapagliflozin? Well, you could, of course, and that is adding it to the heart failure medications and adding it to metformin if the patient is diabetic, because metformin is still first line. You could also switch their ACE or ARB to sucubitril valsartan. In the dapagliflozin trial, roughly 10% of the patients were on sucubitril valsartan. So we don't really know how this dapagliflozin works with or in combination with sucubitril valsartan. We will need more evidence for that to see how they work in combination. And as a reminder, sucubitril valsartan works about the exact same as dapagliflozin. It prevents one cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization for every 21 patients treated over 2 years. That's compared to enalapril. Dapagliflozin prevented about 1 in 20 over 1.5 years, but that was compared to placebo. So it's 6 one way, half a dozen the other, and in the end, they both cost about $500 a month. Yet, I know that dapagliflozin just came out with this brand new trial. There'll be drug reps pushing it in your office. It's new, it's sexy, it's shiny, and it works for what we think maybe is everyone. Maybe not just a diabetic drug, but an everyone drug, a patient drug, if you will, except for because it's new, because it's shiny, because it's sexy, because it just came out with this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, it will be a lot harder to get approved than sucubitril valsartan, which means that you might actually want to go with sucubitril valsartan unless you like filling out medical authorization forms. And of course, no one does. And with that, let's end this podcast, and we'll end it like we always do. So in 60 seconds or less, let's try to cover all the articles I talked about. When we talk to patients about cancer screening, we know that they're listening. However, the thing that we should be telling them is, do you want to do cancer screening or not? Then the choice, it could be up to us. But when we give the choice to the patient, when we let the patient decide colonoscopy or FIT and we give them equal choice, they usually choose FIT. And again, I can't really blame them. That's what I'll be doing when I reach 50. Everyone has biases, and those biases are real whether you want to acknowledge them or not. So let's just understand that decision fatigue is real, and we will almost always prescribe opioids towards the end of the day, even if we take a firm stance against opioids during the start of the day. So in order to combat this, just get used to writing for 3, 4, 5 pills, not very many pills at all. That way, even if you're writing for them, you're only writing for a couple, and you're likely not going to give your patient those long-term adverse effects. When it comes to cancer screening, you can repeat after me, or at least for the elderly individuals, you can repeat after me. You have graduated from cancer screening. You have officially retired from cancer screening. You, sir, are lucky enough to graduate, to retire from, to not have to do cancer screening. There you go. That is what I learned. And although I don't know if cancer screening, or specifically prostate cancer screening, is really relevant for anyone, but I also might have said that placebo medications are really not that relevant for everyone, but this has been proven wrong over and over and over again. And of course, it is. Even in an open label placebo trial, when we tell the patients, we're going to give you placebo. That is right. We will give you placebo. They get better. They get better at a rate of about 1 on an 11-point scale, which is very similar to what NSAIDs are on a 10-point scale. Yes, that's right. They are different studies, so you can't necessarily cross-compare or say that they're identical, but placebo is real. It is very, very real. Amitriptyline, tenofovir, diprioxal. Yes, the HIV PrEP medication. It's going to be generic in approximately 1 year. Know about it. Look for it. Maybe at the end of 2020, beginning of 2021, it'll actually be cost efficient for most individuals. This MDMA that you're going to see, losartan, valsartan, recalls, recall, recall. Don't get your panties in a bundle here, because in the end, we still got to treat hypertension. And maybe even ask your patient if they're still taking it, because maybe they're just stopping it and not telling you. Not that patients would ever do that. And last but not least, dapagliflozin and heart failure. It appears that dapagliflozin is not just a diabetic drug. It is probably realistically a person drug, and it improves cardiovascular deaths and hospitalizations in all individuals, roughly with a number needed to treat of 1 in 20. This is similar to the numbers around sacubitril, valsartan. Very few patients in the trial were actually taking sacubitril, valsartan, so we don't know how dapagliflozin and sacubitril, valsartan work in combination. We don't know if they're synergistic effects, if one of them just replaces the other one. We have no idea. It's really six one way, half a dozen the other. They both cost the same, but you're likely going to have to fill out a lot more authorization forms for the dapagliflozin, because there is almost no way that any insurance company out there at all has approved this yet. And with that, let's end this podcast as we've ended every podcast before it. Wait for the music. And there we go. All right. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.